Anyway, we just want to, we got a couple questions here. First question, I'll just give it over to Mr. Wallace here. He can read it and we can kind of hit it.
He's got a mic on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's so important. He has a mic on.
Yeah, I know. And now a word from our sponsor.
Andrew, you got me back there? Okay, good. Brooks? Okay, well.
Test one, two, test.
We only got a few questions that were actually sent to us, so I'm hoping.
Does he not look the part?
Oh, by the way, I think that's an important issue. Do we look the part? It's part of who we are as representatives of the king, right? So when I first started doing this, I would travel to speak at events, and most of my events are youth events because I think the most important generation is Generation Z, or millennials. So I spend a lot of time with that age group. Well, I would get there, I would wear like shorts, you know, like California wear, right? And I looked at a couple of videos afterwards, and I thought, no, these people actually think that the cold case detective is going to show up. Well, what is a cold case detective? I'm like, I don't want to wear suits to all my talks, because I wore suits all my career, right? So I started to Google cold case detectives on TV. I'm serious.
You shouldn't have told that story.
Do you know what they wear?
Jeans.
This is it. They wear jeans, a jacket, and a button-up collar shirt with a button on the collar. So I don't go anywhere without wearing this outfit, okay?
Same Google searches I got on.
That's it, baby. Exactly. You could be me. But I don't always wear boots because they're hard to pack. I didn't wear them when I'm local. Anyway, here's the question. What was the one piece of evidence that pushed you over the top, that one piece of convincing evidence for me as looking at Christianity? So a lot of you will ask this question. I get this question asked constantly. There is no one piece because that's not how I make cases. I wish it was. My cases are cumulative circumstantial cases. All of mine are cumulative circumstantial cases. And that shouldn't surprise you because every case we make, for the most part, is built that way. So it's always the weight of that large body of evidences. Remember I showed you the diagram that I was looking at to make the case for Christianity? Now, by the way, if you're working in front of a jury, you want that kind of case, because if your whole case is based on the testimony of one eyewitness, all the defense has to do is eradicate your one eyewitness or the confidence of the jury in your one eyewitness, and your case is going to go away. But when it's built on 150 pieces, it's a lot harder to get rid of your case. And the 149 pieces will help you interpret piece 150. So I think that's why this is a hard call for us, right? If we're Christians in this room and you want to make the case, you have to learn the case. And it's not going to be as easy as you might like. And the case has got to be a little bit better than I was raised this way. And by the way, when I ask that question nationally, that is the number one answer I get. I'm a Christian because I was raised that way. How you were raised is the chief determiner of what you'll believe in every single form of belief. And so, for example, Islam is growing really fast globally. Did you know that? It'll supersede Christianity in about the next 17 years. And it is not because they evangelize better than you guys. They don't. They have more kids than you. And because we believe mostly what we were raised to believe. Boy, do you have a lot of kids?
I got 9 kids.
Well, then you should be a Muslim.
It's for America!
But honestly, the church, for the most part, the Christian church, has bought into a secular view of children. That, hey, they're kind of a pain, and you know, don't want to have too many because it kind of limits your freedoms. We don't see them as a blessing. We see them like, hey, so what happens in America, if it not for immigration, we wouldn't even have the rate we have. It takes 2.3 children per couple to sustain culture. We're at about 2.1 in America because of immigration, mostly from Mexico. In France, I think it's like 1.2, 1.3 per couple. All of Europe is like that. Muslims right around 4, 4.6, right in that range. So Gaddafi said this years ago, we don't need to win Europe by force, we will win Europe by birth. And that's exactly what's happening. So that's a very common answer. But by the way, that's what everyone says. The other common answer I get is, I've had an experience that demonstrated for me that Christianity was true. A miracle. I saw a miracle. A prayer was answered. Some experience that demonstrated for me that Christianity was true. Those are the two most popular answers. Those are good answers. But if I ask my Mormon brothers and sisters, and I have 6, Why is Mormonism true? They give me the same two answers in the same order. And clearly, that doesn't make that system true. We need better answers. And our answers are going to be evidential, and they're going to be built on a cumulative case, and there won't be an easy silver bullet. It's this, the weight of all the historical evidence, the archaeological evidence, the internal evidence, the external evidence. It's about testing reliability. It's about looking at those eight things in the universe and trying to figure out how do we explain these. That took me 18 months and 132 books to read to get ready to write that book. But if we want to be able to make that case to people, we're going to have to invest that kind of time. And by the way, when you invest time, what are you really doing? Aren't you showing the world what you really worship? So where else do we want to spend our time if not in studying God? Okay, I'm off though.
Cool. Do you have any other?
That's enough.
That's the only one. Anybody else want to add
really
to that?
Is.
All right.
Well then.
Give us the million dollar one.
Okay, this is the $1 million question right here. How do you deal with race relations in society that hates white officers? Many officers will no longer make contact with African Americans.
My wife has a really cool idea she told me before, and I'm a huge proponent of it, but I don't understand why the ride-along program was not more active. I worked with a bunch of black college athletes for 15 years, and the police relations with them was easy. As long as the police officers had some connection to them in conversation, it was easy. But the ride-along program is the only way to get people in a car to see what the police do. I don't know what your policy and procedures are. Ours is very liberal. We allow ride-alongs with anybody, with any cops all the time, and the cops hate it. They hate having somebody in their car because they can't take a nap, and they can't pick their nose, and they can't fart. So that's a huge issue to them. But truthfully, that is a huge way to bring society into what we do. So I'm a big fan of the ride-along program. And by the way, I just want to answer one thing. He has 9 kids, and I was sitting there thinking to myself, what else are you going to do in Indiana?
We enjoy it very much. Thank you. I'm a Marine. You know, always on the job in England meant having a physical relationship. So the British guys would come over and join the Marine Corps because they thought, man, you guys know how to do this right.
Well, what was the question?
Anyway, you guys want to start adding to that?
Here's what I might offer to that. So being in California, I don't know if you guys ever hear anything, but it's not quite like the Midwest. And we're just dealing in the last couple of weeks with major deployments down to Cal Berkeley, UC Berkeley for Antifa. And when we don't have that, we have other issues. And probably has caused us... although that's not racial per se, that has caused us to really think pretty deeply about this issue over the last few years. One of the things that happened a couple years ago was there was a bill passed that it was called the Racial Identity and Profiling Act, RIPA. And essentially what it did is it set up a commission in California. I think there's 18 members, four actually went down to three are from law enforcement. And they went around the state and gave open forums in Fresno, San Diego, Oakland was the latest. I know there was another, but people came out and they shared some of their experiences. And as cops, you listen to that, and there's a part of it where you go. In fact, one of them we knew was a bank robbery suspect's mother that he came out of the car and tried to open fire on the officers and. Law enforcement, of course, returned fire and took him, and she had a grievance that she aired, not about the son particularly. And it's really the natural thing for us is just to kind of dismiss it, because we get a case like that, or you get a person like that, and you're thinking, what's your grievance? But then you listen to a lot of the other people, and I was, in listening to this, I was kind of moved, because you realize that for a lot of these people, this really is the reality. This is not, they have not had great contact with law enforcement. And that's the first thing that's difficult for us is to admit that that's the case, because every one of us goes to your own heart and you say, well, I'm not racist, or I don't have issues, or I always make good stops. And yet, in reality, there's enough of these very compelling stories from from just like normal people that come up. They're not the activists. And you could understand, you know, if you could just explain to Stacy's perspective, you could explain the law enforcement perspective, it probably would help. But by the time that they encountered whatever they encountered, they're beyond that. We just had an interesting thing happen in one of my stations. We stopped an African-American young female. She was a student at University of California at Davis, which is just within our division. And she ended up going to NAACP and her legislative representative. And there was a meeting that ensued with our station commander and the public information officer. And they all sat around the table. And at first, this young lady would not even look at our commander, who came in uniform. And just to advance forward, she grew up in Richmond, which is a very, it's a black community just north of Berkeley. And it's, over the years, has had its more than its share of violence and strife and so on. And as the conversation progressed, she said, you know, I've never had a negative contact with law enforcement, but everyone that I interact with has told me my whole life they've reported things that have happened to them or happened to their buddy and so on and so forth. And it had been so much a part of her fabric growing up that it was her reality. So when this officer stopped her and we had the MVARs and everything else, the officer did a great job. And we, of course, we stood by him. But when this dialogue ensued, by the end of it, her body language had changed. We gave, you know, a lot of information. We played the video for her. We explained it. And she turned out to be very, very open and receptive to us. And I shared that with our commanders, and I shared that with a group of officers. In fact, in that office, I made a station visit. And, you know, it's wearying because you think, okay, well, we won her over. And the other things that we do is we have citizens advisory boards. We invite people from a whole variety of communities to weigh in on what we do, and we expose the information. But I think what's very challenging, it just seems like it's always an uphill battle. It's a battle, though, in terms of the information and building those relationships. I don't know if that's even a battle, but it's a very, very important task. And we've all had to admit that maybe we don't see the world. We see it through our lens. We don't necessarily see it through theirs, and we absolutely have an obligation to serve and protect every one of those individuals. And I've worked a lot of black communities in Los Angeles and other places in which the vast majority of people were really, really good people, and there were knuckleheads and hoodlums all around that were basically making their life miserable. And they appreciate what we do, but they're the silent majority. So I guess the conclusion of my answer is, We're getting engaged. We're probably going to end up, I mean, like 99% chance where we have to data report on every traffic stop. That's where this is going, including a small narrative. There's 20 different data fields. So it's essentially a report on a traffic stop. And the way it is that we need to report on what the officer's perception of race, gender. There's 5 gender categories. I'm not an expert on this. And from our perspective in the law enforcement community, it's not good because we look at it, this is going to slow us down and so forth. But if we don't embrace the reality, this very difficult reality that some people are genuinely alienated, and then you've got the professional alienators and the pot stirrers, then we're going to continue to get more and more of the continued hard reality that we've been going into. And if you kind of look at the West Coast where I live and work in police and the men and women that work with me, we're trying to do our best to reverse that trend, to build those relationships, so hopefully, you know, it doesn't spread east from California. So that's not a, you know, terribly satisfying answer, but it's a truthful answer.
You know, I was thinking about this for quite some time, and I always try to think in like 30,000 feet. What are we really doing at 30,000 feet? What can we look at conceptually that might help us think about this? I think part of it is that other people don't do law enforcement. Let's just say this, those of us who are in law enforcement and those of us who aren't. And we have to do a better job of communicating what it is we do. I think what people think is that we get together in briefings and we decide who we're going to go out and harass that day. And it's systemic. You know, though, as a system, we are all inclined to help each other to harass these people, whoever that group might be. It depends on your community. You have different communities with different groups that feel like they've been alienated. When in fact, I think you all know what we do, and once I've communicated this, look, I don't know about you guys, but in our briefings, we go in and we look at the crime trends in our beat for the last 3 days. That's what we do. Those reports are printed out for us. So I can see that on ANZA in the middle of the night, we're getting killed in auto thefts between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. So what do you think we're going to do tomorrow? We're going to be in the alleys of ANZA looking for anyone moving in those alleys. If you told me that I've got a series of robberies in the North End involving two white males who are redheads in a white compact car, guess what I'm looking for tomorrow? It's not because I don't like redheads. It's because I have looked at the last 3 days of crime reports and I've got to solve this problem. And that day, if you happen to be a single redhead who's like in a cream-colored medium-sized car, you're probably going to get pulled over. Well, why? Because I don't like you. I like you. It's just that this is the report I have to work from the days before. But in the end, if we're going to kind of solve this problem, and we're going to come together on the problem as a country, we are going to have to be very honest that there are things that both sides, what I mean by both sides, is law enforcement. I don't think it's even a race issue anymore. I think it's really anti-law enforcement now. Because you could be any race working in law enforcement, they're not going to see you any differently. It's law enforcement versus the world sometimes. It feels that way. And I think if you don't admit that both sides have something that we can celebrate and something for which we must repent, we're going nowhere. Each side wants to say, hey, you know what? I got stuff I can celebrate, but there's nothing I need to change. If both sides say that, that's why we're going nowhere. Now, this makes nobody happy, by the way, because when I talk about this in front of police officers, everyone's ticked off that I'm saying we have something we should own up to. It's going to be different for each person, different for each agency. But, of course, the other side doesn't like it either. You realize that if you look at the violent contacts we have nationally, they have to be measured not in terms of, like, they have to be measured in terms of police contacts, calls for service. So if 34 million calls for service, if we have 10 bad shootings, do you know how infinitesimally small that fraction is in terms of all the contacts we have nationally in law enforcement across the country? But all of us are now being judged for the activity of a very small percentage. Well, if you look at for example, take any community, if it's Hispanic, if it's Asian, they break them down now demographically, if it's African American, you realize that the vast majority of crime in the African American community is repeat offender crime. The actual percentage of people in the African American community that are committing crimes is incredibly small. They're just all repeat offenders. They don't like being judged as a group for what a small percentage is doing. Don't you see how we're both in the same position? Neither one of us likes being judged for what we know a small percentage of the other side is doing. That's not always a popular message. And when it comes to racism, do we have a race problem? Yeah. Is that like ground shaking that I would say that? Do you know what we really have? We have an otherism problem. It's endemic. It's part of the human condition. It's otherism. If we were all the same race, all the same sex, same hair color, same eye color, trust me, we would find a way to divide from each other over something else. This is why in South Central Los Angeles, I have groups of young men who have the exact same socioeconomic upbringing. They have the exact same race. They live across the street from each other. Some are from families that have only been divided because now I'm living with my half-brothers over here instead of the other side. Yet they are killing themselves over what? Over color. Colors of clothing that they're choosing to wear. So trust me, if we're all exactly the same, we will still find a way to divide from our neighbor. Oh, you live on the odd side of the street. I live on the even side of the street. Odds are odd. Evens are okay. We will find a way to divide because we have this fallen human condition that the Christian worldview actually explains. This enigma of man, designed in the image of God, capable of great beauty, but deeply rebellious and fallen and so prideful that we think we're better than everybody else, and so we will find a way to divide from each other. So I think we do have some bigger issues, but these are otherism issues. And I remember one time I was showing my Glock to my German family, okay? And we carry a Glock 21 on our agency. So I'm showing my wife's German family, they don't speak any English, I'm showing them this gun. And they said, who makes this gun? I said, it's Austrian. It's trash. Okay, these folks live in Memmingenberg, which is about 60 miles from the Austrian border. You cannot tell them apart from Austrians in dialect. You can't tell them apart in food. You can't tell them apart in physical appearance. But they have just chosen to divide over that line on the dirt. that says that's Austria, this is southern Germany. They refuse to accept anything Austrian. Don't you see this as part of the human condition? It's endemic. And we have to figure out whether we're willing. And by the way, there is one thing that unifies all of us. It is our need for a Savior. And so if we aren't allowed to preach the gospel, there will be no unifying message in America. The flag is not strong enough to unify us. You can see that now. But our need for a Savior is strong enough. And that's why I think we have to return to the gospel.
Hey, just one thing. One of the things I'm seeing, and the chief talked about what his employees are having to do, from being an administrator and now being back on the road as a deputy, cops aren't working anymore. They're responding, but they're not taking proactive calls. They're not being proactive. And they're doing that for a reason. And we have 60 cops on the road at a time, just deputies. And there might be one traffic stop all night. They're not doing self-initiated calls. They've figured out the system. The system is to do the minimum and not get burnt. And that's what they're doing. And it's not my agency. It's across the board in this country. Law enforcement has stopped proactive work out of fear of retaliation and the fear of negative attention. And that's the reality. So the more stipulations we put on them and the more requirements they have and the more things, they just stop working. And they won't find that car anymore. They'll ride right past that car because it's not worth it to do it anymore because of the complaints and negative attention. And folks, there was nobody that had more of a demand on their employees than I did when I was a lieutenant and a sergeant. And now I sit back and think, no wonder they're not doing anything anymore, because I went through it too. So just a different perspective of what's happening out there on the road.
That's a great point, though, what he's saying, because my son Jimmy, right, he's working at patrol. He's a field training officer right now. He's got trainees. And even worse in California. Jerry Brown came in and decided that he was going to alleviate our overcrowding in the penitentiary system or in the county jail system. And he basically made a misdemeanor of most of the stuff that used to be felonies that our guys would stop people for, like felony possession of narcotics. There is no felony possession of narcotics anymore. That's a misdemeanor. That means you're going to take that guy, you're going to cite him out, he'll be in jail for 15 minutes. And so what's happened is people are like, not only that, if I don't have the felony context in which to do a consensual search, or in which to do a car search. This is all misdemeanor stuff now. So what's the point in pulling that car over? What you used to use as the foundation for doing your car search is no longer a felony. It's no longer available to you. So everyone, he said to tell his trainees, dude, look, you're in training. If you're waiting, rolling around here looking for a felony, there are no felonies anymore. We're in California, okay? You better be ready to take someone to jail for a misdemeanor. Sorry, just get over it because you're in training. You need to do something. You can't just drive in circles all night. So he said to help his trainees realize it's a new age in California right now. I don't know if that's coming your way, but it's changed. You know this already, right? Chief, you know this too.
Yeah. We just lost a deputy to one of those guys in Sacramento a month ago.
Who has been released on the release. Yeah, yes. This is so common.
I just want to throw in a couple things, but I think the first thing we got to come to the realization is we look at society. This is one of the many questions that are confronting law enforcement. But I believe with all my, the way I stay sane is I realize this, that evil's number one tactic to destroy me is to get me upset about the things that are out of my control till it affects the things that are in my control. You can think about the fact when you all got jobs as a cop. You remember that rookie thrill, you know? I can't believe you're paying me to do this job. I do it twice as long for half the price. But you fast forward 17 years last year, and the same ingredients of less than perfect clientele, less than perfect leadership, you got a guy eating his gun at 17 years for the same things. And so the point gets to be is evil sits there and tries to get you upset about this, that, all the things out of your control until it affects the things in your control. So as we approach the day and hour, we got to realize I can do so much. And there's stuff that's not mine to carry. I do my part with excellence. At the end of the day, I can hang my head high. I can go to sleep. But you know, I think one of the things we need to do is find partnerships. Okay, it's hard to do, but you know, I have several of our chaplains that are just quality, just African American leaders who really care. And we've sit down and we've wrestled with the issues. We've heard each other out, hopefully respectfully, and we've started doing things like a stops thing where we bring them in and show them the reactionary gap, show them how quick cops have to make decisions, things like that, and it's eye opening. You know, the other thing we talk about is the fact that the judicial process, our schools aren't teaching what the limited role of law enforcement is anymore. So oftentimes there's frustrations with things in the judicial system or the legislative system that have nothing to do with us, but they don't realize that we have nothing to do with the system in that. And so part of it gets to be is to build that capital in times of non-conflict, to go in there and say, listen, you know, I don't wait till there's a crisis to build relationships. And I really try to encourage my guys to do the same thing. It's hard, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, I think we got to realize we're fighting a battle against evil, and evil exploits things. You know, you remember those slides up there about ethnic group arise against ethnic group. Okay, there's a real playing of that. If we really look at demographics and we look in the African-American community, when you see the a lack of fatherhood in there, and just do research on fatherhood. It doesn't matter if you're white, black, Hispanic. At the end of the day, if you remove father figures from there, the first disciplinarian often is a law enforcement officer who shows up in someone's life. And so therefore, if we're not careful, the way evil gets us doing things is we turn around and we say, listen, it's white and black. Well, no, it isn't. It's fatherlessness oftentimes. As fatherlessness, where we look out and we make certain judgment calls. So guess what? If I have any demographic, I don't care if you're rainbow-colored, if you have 80% fatherlessness, then you're going to have a disproportionate amount of crime for your rainbow family. And you know what? It's happy hunting grounds in the rainbow land. You know. And so I think it's just a matter of number one, to try to have honest discussions about stuff, to sit there and try to build relationships in times of non-conflict, and then to come along and to find those partners that you can build with who will be there and help to facilitate understanding and then build off of that. And at the end of the day, I can't control the big picture, but in a microcosm, you know, I got brothers here that I love dearly that we're building good relationships with, and as a department, we're reaching out and trying to make a difference in doing that. So
that issue about fatherlessness is so powerful. I remember I worked gangs in Los Angeles, and on the west side we had Hispanic multi-generational gangs in the north, and we had African-American gangs in the south, and we had these guys called the Lost Boys, all white gangsters. And then on the west side, we had this unusual group I had never worked with before of Korean gangsters. And I thought, what is the common denominator? My boys were like 2 and 4 at the time. And I was really concerned about it. I was really like, I want to know what it is that causes this. And it is always lack of dad, but lack of dad looks different in different groups. So in the Hispanic community, it was all these guys were locked up. They were in MA. They were either role models of being long-term gangsters, or they were unavailable by way of arrest. Sometimes in the African-American community, maybe they didn't even know who dad was from the time he was very young. In the white community, dad was a deadbeat who would either he was gone or drunk or asleep on the couch. In the Korean community, dad was living at home, but had come over and never even learned to speak English. He was making good money, running a business, working 80 hours a week. His kids are driving Acuras, and they were deadly. Lack of dad looks different depending on your group. And that, for me, was powerful because I realized, wait a minute, that could be, how many times do you know cops' kids who end up being like PKs, pastors' kids, like a train wreck? Why does that happen? It's lack of dad. Just lack of dad in a different way. And that's pretty convicting. One thing that helped me too, that might help you guys too in the field, and gals who are doing this in uniform, I remember when I became a Christian, it changed the way I would argue with my wife. Because, I realized that every argument I had with my wife was no longer between me and Susie. This was between me and God. Every conversation I had was between me and God. So every word that came out of my mouth at the end of the day, I said to myself, you know what? I don't want to say anything that I have to apologize to God for at the end of this conversation. Because this isn't between me and Susie. This is between me and him. And I knew that standard was pretty high. And it changed the way I was willing to interact with her. A lot of things I just realized that, you know what? That wasn't what I think God would have me say in that setting. And since this conversation is now between me and him and not between me and her, it changed everything. So I realized also it started to change the way I would work, that every conversation and every interaction I had was no longer with me and somebody I didn't know. It was, what does God expect from me in this interaction? And it did change the way that I started to interact with people.
Excellent. Well,